Case number 21-2685, Helena Millman versus Feiger and Feiger PC et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Savage, you may proceed for the appellant when you are ready.
May it please the court, Molly Savage from Deborah Gordon Law on behalf of the plaintiff, Paulina Millman. I'd ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
I guess I'll start by apologizing for my voice here. It's seasonal allergies. I've taken a lot of COVID tests.
Wow. almost everybody seems to struggle with these.
Yeah.
Pollen right now.
A little devastated that I sound like a frog, but we are going to keep going here. So I'm excited to present this case. It's very interesting for many reasons, but most of all because it involves an issue of first impression for this court, and that is whether the FMLA's anti-retaliation provision protects an eligible employee who makes a request for FMLA leave but does not ultimately take it. So I want to today highlight three main points. I want to touch briefly first on the fact that this court has not decided this issue. And then I would like to take some time and do a deep dive into the text of 2615. I want to make some...
Dive right in, or, you know, to what you want to talk about.
Okay. So I guess I'll start here with the fact that this court hasn't decided this issue. Every case relied on by the district court and defendants, which applies an entitlement requirement, is not applicable here because those cases involve an employee who exercised the right to take leave. That's not the right that's being exercised in this case. This case doesn't involve the FMLA right to take leave. Plaintiff alleges a different right, the right to request leave or inquire about taking leave. So in those cases, in Branham, Morris, Edgar, et cetera, the entitlement to take leave is a requirement because the employee has no right to take leave without the presence of one of those qualifying conditions. We know this because 2612 says employees are entitled to leave for one of the following reasons. The right to leave is contingent on those qualifying conditions being present. If an employee takes leave without...
I'm confused. So she did take, or she didn't go to work, right?
She did work. She worked from home. So, as she was instructed to do.
So that's not, you're saying that's not, so Thursday was not leave?
It was not leave.
Okay.
She requested leave on Thursday and she was instructed to work from home instead.
Okay, and are you saying that she wouldn't have been entitled to take the leave? Did she have a right to take the leave?
She did not. We've conceded that she doesn't have an entitlement because her son didn't ultimately end up having a serious health condition. So I don't think that's that issue.
Just the question of whether somebody who's requesting leave, although she didn't request FMLA leave, right? She just requested unpaid leave, and then, but didn't have an entitlement to it, but was, you're saying, fired because of it.
So I think she did request FMLA leave. She doesn't use the words FMLA leave, but she doesn't have to. And she's requesting unpaid leave to care for a sick child. The issue here really is, so she ultimately ends up not being entitled to take leave, but she did request it. She just happened to not end up using it because she was fired before her request went anywhere. She was fired, you know, hours later.
Why do we even need to reach her, the propriety of her request?
Say again?
Why is the propriety of her request in any way related here? there are allegations. We're at the complaint stage.
Right.
There are allegations of a serious illness, RSV, and a danger from that. So if we are distinguishing Branham and similar cases, then the whole issue is whether she had a right to undertake the interactive process, right?
I think the issue here is whether in being entitled to take leave is a requirement for all FMLA-protected activity. That's what the district court held here.
I think that's a fair statement of the issue.
So to summarize why Branham, Morris, those cases are not applicable, I think I don't think this is made clear in our briefs. The court doesn't need to find that those statements about this entitlement requirement are dicta or anything like that. They're just not applicable because the right being asserted there is not the right that's being asserted.
I understand your point, but I do think it's true that opinions, the holding is not necessarily limited only to the facts. Sometimes you have a more general proposition.
Sure.
And so one question I have for you here about Branham is the opinion in a couple places seems to speak categorically about an element, a particular element of an interference or retaliation claim. And just to read it, so it's talking about these claims arguably, and I'm asking you to explain why it's not true, but arguably it's saying categorically, for these types of claims, here's an element. And it says, to prevail on either her interference claim or her retaliation claim, Branham must prove she was entitled to FMLA leave.
Obviously this isn't dispositive, but the court's saying there to prevail on her claim.
Yeah, okay.
Branham has to show this. Yeah. And I guess I want to move now into the text of 2615 because I think it does conclusively show that there's no entitlement requirement for all FMLA-protected activity. That statement in law that Judge Kethledge just read from Branham, the same holding in the district court here, it's applying an entitlement requirement to all forms of FMLA-protected activity, which means that one of two things has to be true. Either the only FMLA-protected activity is taking FMLA leave, or the only people protected by 2615 are people who are qualified to take FMLA leave. Mm-hmm. So both of these outcomes or consequences are contrary to the text because 2615 is much, much broader than this. So if we look at the A2 prong, just on its face, it says nothing about entitlement to take leave. What it does say is that an employer shall not discharge or discriminate against, quote, any individual who opposes any practice made unlawful under this act. So who does that apply to? Any individual, not just employees entitled to take leave.
I think you're right that I think there are some cases where you wouldn't have to show that you're entitled to the FMLA leave. And maybe it's A2, but that would be like a whistleblower type situation, wouldn't it? Where I'm complaining about, I'm opposing a practice that's unlawful under this. I don't necessarily have an entitlement, but I'm opposing the practice. I'm speaking out, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Does your client fall within this provision? I mean, I don't know.
Sure. It
seems to me that she's claiming that the employer interfered or restrained or denied the exercise. This is an A1 claim, isn't it? It's not an A2 claim.
Okay, so that's a great point to clarify here. So there's these two prongs, and neither one of them says retaliation, right?
But which one are you claiming under?
So we're claiming a retaliation theory, and this court has held... say again?
You have an A1 claim here?
If I could just continue, this court has said that retaliation comes out of A2, that it arises out of A2. The implementing regulations say otherwise. They say that this retaliation theory, all retaliation theories come out of A1. But they also recognize that the Sixth Circuit's reasoning, saying that it comes out of A2, is also correct. So the implementing regulation says, word for word here, the prohibition on interference, meaning A1, prohibits the employer from retaliating for exercising a right or attempting to exercise a right. And the commentary...
But that seems to me to be, maybe there's some loose language about what retaliation is.
Yeah.
But if I do something, I try to take leave and I get fired, you might colloquially say that was a retaliation for me doing this. But it wouldn't be the same as a retaliation against, again, like a whistleblower.
Yeah.
The first person has what I would say is a direct discrimination claim. You can call it retaliation, but you're getting fired for exercising the right. That's A1,
yeah.
Not A2. So I'm just,
yeah.
Seems like we're playing around with what we've called retaliation, where it fits under A1 or A2, but I'm just looking at this text of the statute saying your client has a claim under A1, it seems to me, and if it's an A1 claim, it seems to me you have to have an entitlement to the leave.
Yeah, so Judge Nalbandian, the implementing regulations agree with you. This court has held otherwise, that it comes out of A2. I would point the court to Judge Sutton's opinion in Smith v. City of Niles. It's from 2012. He sort of nicely summarizes the interaction between the two prongs and basically ends up saying, you know, it's kind of a chicken and the egg problem here. If you interfere with an employee's right, you've retaliated against them. If you've discriminated or retaliated against an employee, you've also interfered with their rights. So Judge Sutton ends up saying, between these two prongs, we readily find that there's a retaliation theory available. And regardless of which prong we use, we apply McDonnell-Douglas retaliatory framework under either prong. And this court's done that repeatedly. We point this out in our brief. We say out of, you know, one side of our mouth that retaliation comes out of A2, but this court frequently replies the McDonnell-Douglas framework to claims brought under A1. So I think the takeaway is that between these two prongs, there's a retaliation theory available, and the language of both becomes relevant.
But if there's a theory, I mean, it's obviously there's a theory available because, you know, we recognize this type of claim in the Sixth Circuit. I think the question is whether one must have, as Branham is saying, at least in that case, one must have actually an FMLA entitlement to leave.
Right, so if I can go back to the text of 2615.
So, yeah.
So Judge Nalbandian makes this point with A2. Obviously, that language, this opposing language, leaves room for somebody to fall within the purview of A2 without taking leave, right? The same is true of A1.
I see that.
So A1, A, says nothing about entitlement. B, it says that an employer can't interfere with an employee's attempt to exercise a right as well as their exercise of a right.
But if you're saying you could interfere with somebody's attempt to exercise a right that they actually don't have because it's an attempt?
I'm saying that there's nothing, that language demonstrates that taking FMLA leave is not the only FMLA protected activity. Therefore, an entitlement to FMLA leave is not a requirement under 2615.
Well, what is the other protected activity and where do we find that?
Sure. If I could just make this one point on the language.
Real
here.
Quick, because, I mean, we're... You know.
Sorry, yeah.
Okay.
So if you compare 2615 with 2614, which deals with reinstatement of employee, 2614 literally includes language saying... This section applies to people who have taken leave under 2612. If Congress wanted to put that entitlement requirement in 2615, it could have done something very similar and said that only these people who have taken leave, who are entitled to leave under 2612, are entitled to bring a retaliation claim. Judge Gottlieb, do you want me to get back to your point on? Sorry. Sorry, so what did you say?
You can answer my question in 30 seconds and maybe it'll remind me what it
okay,
was.
Okay, so your question was, where's the right to take leave or
so,
to request leave?
You know, it's talking about sort of, you know, stuff you can't do.
Right.
I mean, where is what provision do you point us to that says my client had an entitlement, I guess, to ask the question she asked on that particular day?
So I don't want to confuse the language. It's that she had a right to request leave, not that she was entitled to leave.
Okay, well, call it what you will.
So,
what section
sure.
says she had a right to request leave?
In order to take leave, you have to request it. It's literally a requirement in the Act. It would be illogical to have this notice requirement and interpret it in a way that requires employees to request leave and then gives them zero protection for exercising that right. It's also very important to understand what a request actually does. It triggers the employer to provide three different notice obligations. When an employee requests FMLA leave, the employer has to let them know whether or not they're eligible, what their rights and responsibilities are, and they have to supply a designation notice. So it's only the employer who can say, we're designating this leave as FMLA qualifying. So the employee is entitled to receive a response from their employer as to whether or not they're requesting leave for an FMLA qualifying condition or not. That's how you get the response back from the employer. The right comes from that.
Okay, I think it's the
initiation of the interactive process.
Correct, yes.
Okay, well, we should probably let Mr. Kamenek have his turn, and you'll have your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. Rob Kamenek, I represent the defendant appellees. Entitlement, as the court has already fleshed out, entitlement is an element of an FMLA retaliation claim. I mean, that's really what this whole issue comes down to. I don't think that counsel is properly interpreting the statute, to be candid. And I'll add to that that I don't believe, on top of that, that the terms of the First Amendment complaint remotely reflect what's being argued here today. And as the court well knows, we're here on a motion to dismiss, where Judge Murphy took a look at the First Amendment complaint and found that there was not a claim of entitlement so asserted. But equally important here, this whole theory about this particular provision of the act and how it comes into play was never pled. And I do think that's
I mean, does one plead theories of the act in a complaint as opposed to just throw out a section symbol or a section number?
No, but no, I would agree with that. But one does talk about whether the, as the court has noted, whether or not somebody is objecting to the process altogether. That's not the way the First Amendment complaint reads. First Amendment complaint is simply that my child was sick. I sent you a notice. It's in the email. I'm sure the court has reviewed it. You said no, and that was a violation of the act. Nobody was going down the road of saying that the rest of the process was improper. I don't see that anywhere in the First Amendment complaint.
With the concept of notice pleading. I mean, that's a complaint is here to put a party on notice of what the claims may be. And I don't understand how a claim that is given voice to retaliation for action, where the factual basis of what occurred could support that, is inadequate to satisfy notice pleading.
Well, when the facts, reading them in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, does not talk about opposing the practice, as the very statutory citation that we just went through. When there's no facts that plausibly get to that point, then the court is warranted to find that that particular factual theory is not in the complaint. So notice pleading, I'm sorry, Aaron, go ahead. Notice pleading always goes so far. Notice pleading has to be based on something that gives you notice.
But your argument here is that the only claim that could be made is that she was entitled to take a leave. Isn't that the core basis? It's the Branham argument that makes you say that the facts alleged in this complaint are inadequate. Is that incorrect?
It's correct, but not complete. What I'm saying is that the factual allegations in the complaint don't go toward the theory that you're hearing about today, a whistleblower-type theory found in
I don't think she alleges a whistleblower type theory. I think her argument is that I requested leave that should have been categorized as FMLA leave to initiate the interactive process that is provided for in the Family Medical and Leave Act. And because I did that, you responded with an offer to work from home, which I accepted, and then you fired me in retaliation.
All right. If I don't believe that, the court obviously disagrees with me. I don't think you can take the complaint to read that. I think the gravamen of the complaint here is very simply that I had a sick child, I wanted to stay at home, and what was given to the employer here was a reason that's specifically excluded as being a qualified FMLA event.
Well, I mean, couldn't one read the allegations basically to the gravamen to be she made an inquiry about taking FMLA leave, and because of the employer's reaction to the inquiry was retaliatory because they fired her because of the inquiry.
Your Honor,
isn't that consistent? Isn't that a retaliation theory? Or
it is, but I'm not sure if the complaint could be read that way. And if we disagree, I'll just move on that.
I'm not trying to give you a hard time.
No, you're not. I accept the challenge, Your Honor, and that's why we're here. But at the end of the day, you can go through the complaint, and if you go to the notice provision that's required under the statute, you know, you have to give notice to the extent that it triggers an obligation of the employer to do something, to inquire more. And we have a lot of cases cited to the court whereby the notice provision isn't enough. This case is the epitome of a case where you didn't have to do anything more, because not only it wasn't a situation where the reason given was unclear, it was a situation where the reason given was explicitly excluded from being a qualified event.
How does it work that she then alleges that after I made this request for unpaid leave, you instead said to me, as a firm, you may work from home for that day? She opted, this is all within the first week of COVID. She took paid, I think unpaid time off, or PTO, I'm not sure whether she had any coverage, any monetary coverage or not, on the Monday and Tuesday. She was already scheduled to work from home from Wednesday. And then she asked to be able to take leave for Thursday and Friday. The response was, no, you may work from home. So she said, yes, I will. Evening of Thursday, she gets a letter that says you're fired.
Well, there's an intervening event, Your Honor. You totally skipped over the email.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be aggressive. I apologize. The intervening event is that the reason she gives for working at home is a reason that falls specifically outside of FMLA.
But I thought you were, I'm sorry, I'm confused, because I thought you were claiming she never made an FMLA leave claim. So she made the claim, she initiated the process, let's say, and rather than saying as an employer, all right, let me look at this, let's work our way through, the employer said to her specifically, why don't you just work from home? The employer made an offer to her of an alternative provision, and she accepted it and was working from home when she received a letter of discharge.
Right. And it was all precipitated by the email. It was all precipitated by an email that falls specifically outside of FMLA.
Well, I don't get that. Is that because she's saying the child has cold symptoms and that's not a serious health condition?
Correct.
Okay. So your point is, or your argument is, that the facts alleged in the complaint do not plausibly make out an invocation or even an inquiry about FMLA leave. Is that what you're driving at here?
That's one of the arguments, correct.
Right.
I'll move on. The other argument is that it's the legal argument. It's the question of law that we explored earlier.
Right.
With respect to retaliation claim, is entitlement an element of that claim? And that's where we go down the road of the Morris case and the Branham case. And all the cases, I mean, the parties cite to the court plenty of cases in their respective briefs.
Yes, but all of those cases involve someone who took leave without authority, took leave that was not owed to them. And the distinction here is that she alleged in her complaint that she initiated an action, was made a counter offer by her employer to do it differently, and she accepted that offer. It was the right given her to work from home that is the factual issue here. And then, having accepted that offer, she was denied, she was fired.
Your Honor, I understand your point. I'm looking at the First Amendment complaint. I think that you're probably keying in on paragraph 61. But I do think the complaint that she makes in this case, dealing with paragraphs 90 and 91, deal with the entire process here, not just that one leg.
So I'm struggling with your argument then is that without engaging in a response and an interactive process after she raises the request, the employer can discharge her while she is engaged in the process that was offered.
My point more precisely is that when you have a situation that's completely divorced from FMLA, you don't have a retaliation claim. In this case, in this situation, is completely divorced from FMLA.
Because of the email in your view?
Yes.
I don't have it in front of me. Somehow I left all my relevant...
Quoted to Your Honor, short, if it would...
Yeah, please.
Would help, sure. This is dated, and it's March 19th, 2020, and I'm going to quote the entire thing.
How long is this thing?
Three lines. I'll take it out of my
go
time.
Ahead, sir. Yes,
okay?
Sir.
Wanda, who's the HR director. My child is showing the beginnings of some mild symptoms I would normally associate with a cold. Under these circumstances, I cannot dismiss any symptoms, especially in a child. I strongly feel I need stay away from the office if at all possible at this time. If unpaid time away from the office is an option and the only option, I would do that. Let me know.
Okay, so thank you. I mean, I'm understanding your argument to be that this email is sort of this intervening event that makes clear we are not in an FMLA zone. Is that fair?
Correct.
And I guess, you know, can you remind me, is that email referred to or otherwise sort of part of the pleadings or complaint for purposes of the decision here?
It's referenced in the First
Correct.
Amendment complaint.
Okay, so
and we have the commercial case, my footnote, that we can use it on a motion to dismiss.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so it's fair game. We have to look at that in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, it would seem. And she says, under the circumstances, which include we're in week one or week two of COVID, and arguably also include her son's prior respiratory disease. So I'm not so clear, for 12b6 purposes at least, that email is this intervening event that takes this out of FMLA altogether. Is there, I mean...
Well...
You could tell me how I'm wrong, or we could talk about Branham or whatever.
You had interwoven in your statement that we're in the first weeks of COVID. And let me address that.
Okay.
Because I think that is important, and I think that's kind of the overlay in this case.
What was the date of the email?
March 17th, I believe.
Okay. So, I mean, this was when it was starting to happen.
Just starting. And the difficulty is that, you know, fear of COVID is not considered to be a serious health condition.
I'm not talking about fear of it, but, you know, I mean...
But that's...
But folks at that time, I mean, so we put ourselves in the shoes of your firm, and, you know, is this a clear signal that we don't have to worry about FMLA? Well, you know, if she's saying my kid might have COVID, it's not so obvious at that time that, oh, okay, well, that's not a serious health condition. I mean, quite the contrary. Isn't that fair?
Well, various assumptions. The complaint, I mean, I went through it in the brief. The complaint talks about a condition in the past. There is
no complaint. I think we need to be really careful with the facts here.
Sure.
The complaint talks about what her child had had. Her 2-year-old son had been hospitalized for 5 days with RSV. Mm-hmm. And RSV is a child killer. There is no question. You can look that up anywhere. And her response then was, in light of COVID and his earlier sickness, I don't want to come into the office. I think my major concern about your argument is that she sent that email, I think you state, on March 17.
I'm sorry, it's March 19th, just so.
March 19th, thank you. I thought it was, that was my note, that it was earlier. In response to that email, the Human Resources Department offered her the opportunity to work from home for the remainder of the week. She accepted, and then she was terminated Thursday night.
And I know we're on a motion to dismiss, so I can't go outside the record. And I won't.
Okay.
I've been up here too many times to know better.
Thank you.
At the end of the day, there are reasons for that, but we're on a motion to dismiss. So I know my time's up. I just believe that, and I didn't have a chance to address the statute, but it is an A1.
Let me ask you a question.
A1 statute.
Ms. Savage makes the argument. So the question is whether making an inquiry, let's just say that one could construe the facts here to be a request about FMLA leave, all right? And I do understand your argument to the contrary, but if we construe the facts that way, can an employer fire somebody for asking about, inquiring about taking FMLA leave? Ms. Savage says, well, taking leave is protected, and in order to take leave, you have to be able to request leave. And so, sort of by implication, a request is protected too. And I want to give you a chance to respond or otherwise explain why you think, as a statutory matter, this is precluded for people who aren't, in fact, eligible.
I'll pick you up on the last point. I'm just looking at the statute. It should be unlawful for any employer to interfere with, restrain, or deny the exercise of the attempt to exercise, quote, any right provided under this subchapter.
That's A1.
Period.
Right?
And this is an A1 case.
So tell me why you think it's only an A1 case and why A2 is just, because I think Ms. Savage was quoting A2 up here.
But she is quoting A2.
Why is A2 an apposite?
A2, because I don't think that there's a plausible reading of the complaint that she's opposing the practices.
Okay.
That's the best and only answer I have for you.
You're straight answers, and I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
But there's another answer based on your briefing, isn't there? You argue that the ADA is concerned with the finding of disability required to trigger the statutory protections, and that's kind of the core of your argument here today. But in doing so, the cases that you cite for that basis are pre-2009 cases. Isn't that correct?
I'm just checking Hurley, but...
Well, you can check, but my reading of that was that they were pre the ADA Amendments Act of 2008.
Oh, that...
And that the law changed in the ADA Amendment Acts of 2008 you know, effectively legislatively overruling those, the underpinnings of those earlier cases. And now the cases that are cited in the opposing brief are less focused on this finding of disability and more focused on the interactive process for requests made in good faith. So to me, that's a problem. I think the case law is distinct from what your brief says.
And I know my time's up. Can I make one statement in response?
Please.
And then I'll try to end this. One of the difficulties with the good faith argument altogether is when you look at all these cases, at the time that there's the alleged good faith, somebody is doing something with a doctor. Somebody's taking somebody in for treatment. Somebody's checking out by way of an examination. Somebody is taking affirmative steps because they're concerned about a present condition. Arguably, it may not rise to a serious health condition. That's what's missing from this entire complaint.
And is that not the request to find out that doctor information? Is that not the standard part of the interactive process that is initiated by the request for coverage under the FMLA?
I would disagree, Your Honor. I think that's the process. I think you have to have that condition when you go into the process to start the process. And none of that was going on here.
But the doctor's information is what is requested at the employer stage of the interactive process, correct?
By the certificate, certification process. Sure. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, sir. We'll hear rebuttal.
Okay, I do want to make one thing clear about these two prongs, and I'm going to give the court a case to maybe look at. It's a Second Circuit case from 2017 called Wood v. Start. It gives a really nice overview of how the different circuits are handling A1 versus A2 versus there's the implementing regulations. And again, it sort of I don't know that any retaliation claim is strictly under A1 or strictly under A2. I think retaliation comes from the play between the two of them.
To kind of pick up where we left off with Mr. Kamenek, I mean, the factual allegations in this complaint, I don't see how this is an A2 case. I see her making an inquiry. I don't see her opposing any practice here.
I don't think she is either.
Yeah.
You know, we go over this in our papers, and it's in our briefing in the district court as well. There is a lot of confusion about does retaliation come out of A1 or A2? We're not saying that she's opposing a practice. We're saying that she's exercising a right to be retaliated against for it. Whether the retaliation, you know, retaliation isn't possible without A2 existing in 2615, I think that's another legal question. I think, as Judge Sutton says in the Smith v. City of Niles, we're satisfied that between the two prongs, there's readily a retaliation claim available where someone's exercising.
I'm not really that concerned about the label we give it as opposed to which provision we're dealing with and whether these facts make out a claim. And it seems like we must be dealing with A1.
In that sense, yes. She's not. We're not alleging that she's opposing a practice.
Yeah, I mean, A1 is the provision that decides whether, you know, this claim goes forward or not. And it's whether she stated a claim under A1. It seems to me that is at issue here. And A1 says it's unlawful for the employer to do three different things, three different verbs, or, you know, basically three different verbs. With respect to the exercise or attempted exercise of any right under this subchapter. So, I mean, here's my biggest concern about your argument. Why isn't a sine qua non for an A1 claim, the thing you must have, a right provide, you know, the right provided under this subchapter? And that's what Branham said. So, why isn't that something that you must show?
Because this is not an entitlement theory. So this is sort of the difference between the two theories. There's an entitlement theory which says, I was entitled to this right, I was denied it. There's no sort of inquiry into the employer's motive at all. It's just a, as a matter of fact, were you entitled to this right and did you receive it? This is a retaliation claim because plaintiff is not alleging that she was entitled to receive anything that she did not receive.
I guess I'm just, again, I'm really not focused on what we call it. I'm
sure.
Focused on whether these facts make out a claim under this statutory language. And this language seems to require a, quote, right provided under this subchapter.
Right, and we're alleging that the right here is the right to actually request leave.
Okay, so you're, and so that's very helpful. And where do you get that in the Act?
So.
Just so I make sure I really understand your argument here.
Sure. So the right comes from, A, the fact that it's a requirement. And then I'm also going to point the court to the implementing regulation that deals with.
Wait, but what requirement before, if we're going to the regs this quick, you know, that's not a, well, anyway.
Sure.
What requirement are we talking about
here? The notice requirement, that an employee is required to give notice. It's 2612, I can't remember the subsection.
Okay, all right. And so the employee is required to do something, and so your argument would be, hey, if they're required to do something, then you can't fire them for doing it.
Right, then they have a right to do it. So if I can point to the regs that,
okay.
Excuse me, it's 29 CFR 825, that's .300. This goes over this sort of, as Judge Strange was explaining, an interactive process or this information exchange that is all triggered by the request. It goes through all these different pieces of information that the employee is entitled to because they submitted a request. And it's important information. It's information about whether or not they're allowed to take leave or if they're going to be out here, you know, if they choose to take leave, if they have zero protection for that leave. And it ends with this statement in the regulations. Failure to provide these three notices, the eligibility notice, the designation notice, failure to provide it constitutes an interference with or denial of the exercise of an employee's rights. So the implementing regulations recognize there is a right here to receive this information, and you get this information by requesting leave.
Okay. What's the site for the regs?
Yeah, it's 29 CFR. It's 825.300. I think that's sub E.
All right. Okay.
If you guys don't have any other questions, thank you for your time. Thank you to your staff for your attention and care in looking at this. I really appreciate it. I know my client does too.
Okay. Thank you both for your very fine arguments and briefing in this case. It really was well argued. And the clerk may, or the case will be submitted, and the clerk may adjourn court.